Number two, the wager fire. It was more than a month before the legend of the peacock trees was again discussed in the squire's circle. It fell out one evening when his eccentric taste for meals in the garden that gathered the company around the same table, now lit with a lamp and laid out for dinner in a glowing spring twilight. It was even the same company, for in the few weeks intervening, they had insensibly grown more and more into each other's lives, forming a little group like a club. The American aesthete was, of course, the most active agent. His resolution to pluck out the heart of the Cornish poet's mystery, leading him again and again to influence his flighty host for such reunions. Even Mr. Ashe, the lawyer, seemed to have swallowed his half-humorous prejudices, and the doctor, though rather sad and silent, was a companionable and considerate man. Painter had even read Traherne's poetry aloud, and he read admirably. He had also read other things, not aloud, grubbing up everything in the neighborhood, from guidebooks to epitaphs, that could throw a light on local antiquities. And it was that evening when the lamplight and the last daylight had kindled the colors of the wine and silver on the table under the tree that he announced a new discovery. "Say, Squire," he remarked with one of his rare Americanisms, "about those bogey trees of yours, I don't believe you know half the tales told round here about them. It seems they have a way of eating things. Not that I have any ethical objection to eating things," he continued, helping himself elegantly to green cheese. "But I have more or less, broadly speaking, an objection to eating people." "Eating people," repeated Barbara Vane. "I know a globetrotter mustn't be fastidious," replied Mr. Painter, "but I repeat firmly an objection to eating people. The peacock trees seem to have progressed since the happy days of innocence when they only ate peacocks. If you ask the people here, the fishermen who live on that beach, or the man that mows this very lawn in front of us, they'll tell you tales taller than any tropical one I brought you from the Barbary Coast. If you ask them what happened to the fisherman Peters who got drunk on All Hallows' Eve, they'll tell you he lost his way in that little wood, tumbled down asleep under the wicked trees, and then evaporated, vanished, was licked up like dew by the sun. If you ask them where Harry Hawk is, the widow's little son, they'll just tell you he's swallowed, that he was dared to climb the trees and sit there all night and did it. What the trees did, God knows. The habits of a vegetable ogre leave one a little vague. But they even add the agreeable detail that a new branch appears on the tree when somebody has petered out in this style." "What new nonsense is this?" cried Vane. "I know there's some crazy yarn about the trees spreading fever, though every educated man knows why these epidemics return occasionally. And I know they say you can tell the noise of them among other trees in a gale, and I dare say you can. But even Cornwall isn't a lunatic asylum, and a tree that dines on a passing tourist?" "Well, the two tales are reconcilable enough," put in the poet quietly. "If there were a magic that killed men when they came close, it's likely to strike them with sickness when they stand far off. In the old romance, the dragon that devours people often blasts others with a sort of poisonous breath." Ashe looked across at the speaker steadily, not to say stonily. "Do I understand," he inquired, "that you swallow the swallowing trees, too?" Traherne's dark smile was still on the defensive. His fencing always annoyed the other, and he seemed not without malice in the matter. "Swallowing is a metaphor," he said, "about me, if not about the trees. And metaphors take us at once into dreamland. No bad place, either. This garden, I think, gets more and more like a dream at this corner of the day and night that might lead us anywhere." The yellow horn of the moon had appeared silently, and as if suddenly over the black horns of the seaweed, seeming to announce as night something which till then had been evening. A night breeze came in between the trees and raced stealthily across the turf, and as they ceased speaking they heard not only the seething grass, but the sea itself move and sound in all the cracks and caves round them and below them and on every side. They all felt the note that had been struck. The American as an art critic and the poet as a poet, and the squire, who believed himself boiling with an impatience purely rational, did not really understand his own impatience. In him, more perhaps than the others, more certainly than he knew himself, the sea wind went to the head like wine. Credulity is a curious thing, went on Treherne in a low voice. It is more negative than positive, and yet it is infinite. Hundreds of men will avoid walking under a ladder. They don't know where the door of the ladder will lead. They don't really think God would throw a thunderbolt at them for such a thing. They don't know what would happen. That is just the point. But yet they step aside as from a precipice. So the poor people here may or may not believe anything. They don't go into those trees at night. I walk under a ladder whenever I can, cried Vane in quite unnecessary excitement. You belong to a 13 club, said the poet. You walk under a ladder on Friday to dine 13 at a table, everybody spilling the salt, but even you don't go into those trees at night. Squire Vane stood up, his silver hair flaming in the wind. I'll stop all night in your tomfool wood and up your tomfool trees, he said. I'll do it for 2 pence or 2,000 pounds if anyone will take the bet. Without waiting for reply, he snatched up his wide white hat and settled it on with a fierce gesture, and had gone off in great leonine strides across the lawn before anyone at the table could move. The stillness was broken by Miles, the butler, who dropped and broke one of the plates he carried. He stood looking after his master with his long, angular chin thrust out, looking yellower where it caught the yellow light of the lamp below. His face was thus sharply in shadow, but Painter fancied for a moment it was convulsed by some passion, passing surprise. But the face was quite as usual when it turned, and Painter realized that a night of fancies had begun, like the cross purposes of the Midsummer Night's Dream. The wood of the strange trees toward which the squire was walking lay so far forward on the headland, which ultimately almost overhung the sea, that it could be approached by only one path, which shone clearly like a silver ribbon in the twilight. The ribbon ran along the edge of the cliff, where the single row of deformed trees ran beside it all the way, and eventually plunged into the closer mass of trees by one natural gateway, a mere gap in the wood, looking dark like a lion's mouth. What became of the path inside could not be seen, but it doubtless led round the hidden roots of the great central trees. The squire was already within a yard or two of this dark entry when his daughter rose from the table and took a step or two after him as if to call him back. Treherne had also risen and stood as if dazed at the effect of his idle defiance. When Barbara moved, he seemed to recover himself and, stepping after her, said something which Painter did not hear. He said it casually and even distinctly enough, but it clearly suggested something to her mind. For after a moment's thought, she nodded and walked back, not toward the table, but apparently toward the house. Painter looked after her with a momentary curiosity, and when he turned again, the squire had vanished into the hole in the wood. He's gone, said Treherne, with a clang of finality in his tones, like the slamming of a door. Well, suppose he has, cried the lawyer, roused at the voice. The squire can go into his own wood, I suppose. What the devil's all the fuss about, Mr. Painter? Don't tell me you think there's any harm in that plantation of sticks. No, I don't, said Painter, throwing one leg over another and lighting a cigar. But I shall stop here till he comes out. Very well, said Ash shortly. I'll stop with you, if only to see the end of this farce. The doctor said nothing, but he also kept his seat and accepted one of the American's cigars. If Treherne had been attending to the matter, he might have noted, with his sardonic superstition, a curious fact, that while all three men were tacitly condemning themselves to stay out all night if necessary, all, by one blank omission or oblivion, assumed that it was impossible to follow their host into the wood just in front of them. But Treherne, though still in the garden, had wandered away from the garden table and was pacing along the single line of trees against the dark sea. They had in their regular interstices showing the sea as through a series of windows, something of the look of the ghost or skeleton of a cloister. And he, having thrown his coat once more over his neck like a cape, passed to and fro like the ghost of some not very sane monk. All these men, whether skeptics or mystics, look back for the rest of their lives on that night as on something unnatural. They sat still or started up abruptly and paced the great garden in long detours, so that it seemed that no three of them were together at a time, and none knew who would be his companion. Yet their rambling remained within the same dim and mazy space. They fell into snatches of uneasy slumber. These were very brief, and yet they felt as if the whole sitting, strolling, or occasional speaking had been parts of a single dream. Painter woke once and found Ash sitting opposite him at a table otherwise empty, his face dark in shadow and his cigar end like the red eye of a cyclops. Until the lawyer spoke in his steady voice, Painter was positively afraid of him. He answered at random and nodded again. When he again woke, the lawyer was gone, and what was opposite him was the bald, pale brow of the doctor. There seemed suddenly something ominous in the familiar fact that he wore spectacles. And yet the vanishing Ash had only vanished a few yards away, for he turned at that instant and strolled back to the table. With a jerk, Painter realized that his nightmare was but a trick of sleep or sleeplessness, and spoke in his natural voice, but rather loud. "So you've joined us again. Where's Traherne?" "Oh, still revolving, I suppose, like a polar bear under those trees on the cliff," replied Ash, motioning with his cigar. "Looking at what an older, and you will forgive me for thinking a somewhat better, poet called the Wine Dark Sea. It really has a sort of purple shade. Look at it." Painter looked. He saw the wine dark sea and the fantastic trees that fringed it, but he did not see the poet. The cloister was already empty of its restless monk. "Gone somewhere else," he said with futility far from characteristic. "He'll be back here presently. This is an interesting vigil, but a vigil loses some of its intensity when you can't keep awake. Ah, here's Traherne, so we're all mustered. As the politician said when Mr. Coleman came late for dinner, 'No, the doctor's off again. How restless we all are.'" The poet had drawn near, his feet were falling soft on the grass, and was gazing at them with a singular attentiveness. "It will soon be over," he said. "What?" snapped Ash very abruptly. "The night, of course," replied Traherne in a motionless manner. "The darkest hour has passed." "Didn't some other minor poet remark," inquired Painter flippantly, "that the darkest hour before the dawn..." "My God, what was that? It was like a scream." "It was a scream," replied the poet, "the scream of a peacock." Ash stood up, his strong, pale face against his red hair, and said furiously, "What the devil do you mean?" "Oh, perfectly natural causes, as Dr. Brown would say," replied Traherne. "Didn't the squire tell us the trees had a shrill note of their own when the wind blew?" "The wind's beating up again from the sea. I shouldn't wonder if there was a storm before dawn." Dawn, indeed, came gradually with the growing noise of wind, and the purple sea began to boil about the dark volcanic cliffs. The first change in the sky showed itself only in the shapes of the wood, and the single stems growing darker but clearer, and above the gray clump against a glimpse of glowing light, they saw aloft the evil trinity of the trees. In their long lines there seemed to Painter something faintly serpentine and even spiral. He could almost fancy he saw them slowly revolving as in some cyclic dance. But this, again, was but a last illusion of dreamland, for a few seconds later he was again asleep. In dreams he toiled through a tangle of inclusive tales, each filled with the same stress and noise of sea and sea wind, and above and outside all other voices the wailing of the trees of pride. When he woke, it was broad day, and a bloom of early light lay on wood and garden and on fields and farms for miles away. The comparative common sense that daylight brings even to the sleepless drew him alertly to his feet and showed him all his companions standing about the lawn in similar attitudes of expectancy. There was no need to ask what they were expecting. They were waiting to hear the nocturnal experiences, comic or commonplace or whatever they might prove to be, of that eccentric friend whose experiment, whether from some subconscious fear or some fancy of honor, they had not ventured to interrupt. Hour followed hour, and still nothing stirred in the woods save an occasional bird. The squire, like most men of his type, was an early riser, and it was not likely that he would in this case sleep late. It was much more likely, in the excitement in which he had left them, that he would not sleep at all. Yet it was clear that he must be sleeping, perhaps by some reaction from a strain. By the time the sun was high in heaven, Ash, the lawyer, turning to the others, spoke abruptly and to the point. "Shall we go into the wood now?" asked Painter, and almost seemed to hesitate. "I will go in," said Treherne simply. Then, drawing up his dark head in answer to their glances, he added, "No, do not trouble yourselves. It is never the believer who is afraid." For the second time, they saw a man mount the white curling path and disappear into the gray tangled wood, but this time they did not have to wait long to see him again. A few minutes later, he reappeared in the woodland gateway and came slowly toward them across the grass. He stopped before the doctor, who stood nearest, and said something. It was repeated to the others and went round the ring with low cries of incredulity. The others plunged into the wood and returned wildly, and were seen speaking to others again who gathered from the house. The wild wireless telegraphy, which is the education of countryside communities, spread it farther and farther before the fact itself was fully realized, and before nightfall a quarter of the country knew that Squire Vane had vanished like a burst bubble. Wildly as the wild story was repeated, and patiently as it was pondered, it was long before there was even the beginning of a sequel to it. In the interval, Painter had politely removed himself from the house of mourning, or rather, of questioning, but only so far as the village inn. For Barbara Vane was glad of the traveler's experience and sympathy, in addition to that afforded her by the lawyer and doctor as old friends of the family. Even Treherne was not discouraged from his occasional visits with a view to helping the hunt for the lost man. The five held many councils round the old garden table, at which the unhappy master of the house had dined for the last time, and Barbara wore her old mask of stone, if it was now a more tragic mask. She had shown no passion after the first morning of discovery, when she had broken forth once, speaking strangely enough in the view of some of her hearers. She had come slowly out of the house to which her own or someone else's wisdom had relegated her during the night of the wager, and it was clear from her face that somebody had told her the truth. Miles, the butler, stood on the steps behind her, and it was probably he. "Do not be much distressed, Miss Vane," said Dr. Brown in a low and rather uncertain voice. "The search in the wood has hardly begun. I am convinced we shall find something quite simple." "The doctor is right," said Ash in his firm tones. "The doctor is not right," said the girl, turning a white face on the speaker. "I know better. The poet is right. The poet is always right. Oh, he has been here from the beginning of the world and seen wonders and terrors that are all round our path and only hiding behind a bush or a stone. You and your doctoring and your science. Why, you have only been here for a few fumbling generations, and you can't conquer even your own enemies of the flesh. Oh, forgive me, doctor, I know you do splendidly, but the fever comes in the village, and the people die, and die for all that. And now it's my poor father. God help us all. The only thing left is to believe in God, for we can't help believing in devils." And she left them, still walking quite slowly, but in such a fashion that no one could go after her. The spring had already begun to ripen into summer and spread a green tent from the tree over the garden table when the American visitor, sitting there with his two professional companions, broke the silence by saying what had long been in his mind. "Well," he said, "I suppose whatever we may think it wise to say, we have all begun to think of a possible conclusion. It can't be put very delicately anyhow, but after all, there's a very necessary business side to it. What are we going to do about poor Vane's affairs apart from himself? I suppose you know, he added in a low voice to the lawyer, whether he made a will? He left everything to his daughter unconditionally, replied Ash, but nothing can be done with it. There's no proof, whatever, that he's dead. No legal proof? Remarked Painter dryly. A wrinkle of irritation had appeared in the big, bald brow of Dr. Brown, and he made an impatient movement. Of course he's dead, he said. What's the sense of all this legal fuss? We were watching this side of the wood, weren't we? A man couldn't have flown off those high cliffs over the sea. He could only have fallen off. What else can he be but dead? I speak as a lawyer, returned Ash, raising his eyebrows. We can't presume his death, or have an inquest, or anything, till we find the poor fellow's body, or some remains that may reasonably be assumed to be his body. I see, observed Painter quietly. You speak as a lawyer, but I don't think it's very hard to guess what you think as a man. I own I'd rather be a man than a lawyer, said the doctor rather roughly. I'd no notion the law was such an ass. What's the good of keeping the poor girl out of her property and the state all going to pieces? Well, I must be off, or my patients will be going to pieces, too. And with a curt salutation, he pursued his path down to the village. That man does his duty, if anybody does, remarked Painter. We must pardon his, shall I say, manners or manner? Oh, I bear him no malice, replied Ash good-humoredly, but I'm glad he's gone because, well, because I don't want him to know how jolly right he is. And he leaned back in his chair and stared up at the roof of green leaves. You are sure, said Painter, looking at the table, that Squire Vane is dead? Worse than that, said Ash, still staring at the leaves. I'm sure of how he died. Ah, said the American, with an intake of breath, and they remained for a moment, one gazing at the tree and the other at the table. Sure is perhaps too strong a word, continued Ash, but my conviction will want some shaking. I don't envy the counsel for the defense. The counsel for the defense, repeated Painter, and looked up quickly at his companion. He was struck again by the man's Napoleonic chin and jaw, and as he had been when they first talked of the legend of St. Securus. Then he began, you don't think the trees? The trees be damned, snorted the lawyer. The tree has two legs on that evening. What our friend the poet, he added with a sneer, would call a walking tree. Apropos of our friend the poet, you seemed surprised that night to find he was not walking poetically by the sea all the time, and I fear I affected to share your ignorance. I was not so sure then as I am now. Sure of what? Demanded the other. To begin with, said Ash, I'm sure our friend the poet followed Vane into the wood that night, for I saw him coming out again. Painter leaned forward, suddenly pale with excitement, and struck the wooden table so that it rattled. Mr. Ash, you're wrong, he cried. You're a wonderful man, and you're wrong. You've probably got tons of true convincing evidence, and you're wrong. I know this poet. I know him as a poet, and that's just what you don't. I know you think he gave you crooked answers, and seemed to be all smiles and black looks at once, but you don't understand the type. I know now why you don't understand the Irish. Sometimes you think it's soft, and sometimes sly, and sometimes murderous, and sometimes uncivilized, and all the time it's only civilized, quivering with the sensitive irony of understanding all that you don't understand. Well, said Ash shortly, we'll see who's right. We will, cried Cyprian, and rose suddenly from the table. All the drooping of the aesthete had dropped from him. His Yankee accent rose high like the horn of defiance, and there was nothing about him but the new world. I guess I will look into it myself, he said, stretching his long limbs like an athlete. I search that little wood of yours tomorrow. It's a bit later. I do it now. The wood has been searched, said the lawyer, rising also. Yes, growled the American. It's been searched by servants, policemen, local policemen, and quite a lot of people. And do you know I have a notion that nobody round here is likely to have searched it at all? And what are you going to do with it? Asked Ash. What I bet they haven't done, replied Cyprian. I'm going to climb a tree. And with a quaint air of renewed cheerfulness, he took himself away at a rapid walk to his inn. He appeared at daybreak next morning outside the Vane Arms with all the air of one setting out on his travels to distant lands. He had a field glass slung over his shoulder and a very large sheath knife buckled by a belt around his waist, and carried with the cool bravado of the Bowie knife of a cowboy. But in spite of this backwoodsman's simplicity, or perhaps rather because of it, he eyed with rising relish the picturesque plan and skyline of that antiquated village, and especially the wooden square of the old inn sign that hung over his head. A shield, of which the charges seemed to him a mere medley of blue dolphins, gold crosses, and scarlet birds. The colors and cubic corners of that painted board pleased him like a play or a puppet show. He stood staring and straddling for some moments on the cobbles of the little marketplace. Then he gave a short laugh and began to mount steep streets toward the high park and garden beyond. From the high lawn above the tree and table, he could see on one side the land stretched away past the house into a great rolling plain, which under the clear edges of the dawn seemed dotted with picturesque details. The woods here and there on the plain looked like green hedgehogs, as grotesque as the incongruous beasts found unaccountably walking in the blank spaces of medieval maps. The land, cut up into colored fields, recalled the heraldry of the signboard. This also was at once ancient and gay. On the other side, the ground to seaward swept down and then up again to the famous or infamous wood. The square of strange trees lay silently tilted on the slope, also suggesting, if not a map, at least a bird's eye view. Only the triple centerpiece of the peacock trees rose clear of the skyline, and these stood up in tranquil sunlight as things almost classical, a triangular temple of the winds. They seemed pagan in a newer and more placid sense, and he felt a newer and more boyish curiosity and courage for the consulting of the oracle. In all his wanderings, he had never walked so lightly, for the connoisseur of sensations had found something to do at last. He was fighting for a friend. He was brought to a standstill once, however, and that at the very gateway of the Garden of the Trees of Knowledge. Just outside the black entry of the wood, now curtained with greener and larger leafage, he came on a solitary figure. It was Martin the woodcutter, waiting in the bracken and looking about him in rather a lost fashion. The man seemed to be talking to himself. "I dropped it here," he was saying, "but I'll never work with it again, I reckon. Doctor wouldn't let me pick it up when I wanted to pick it up, and now they've got it, like they've got the squire. Wood and iron, but eating, it's nothing to them." "Come," said Painter kindly, remembering the man's domestic trouble. "Miss Vane will see you have anything you want, I know. And look here, don't brood on all these stories about the squire. Is there the slightest trace of the trees having anything to do with it? Is there even this extra branch the idiots talked about?" There had been growing on Painter the suspicion that the man before him was not perfectly sane. Yet he was much more startled by the sudden and cold sanity that looked for an instant out of the woodman's eyes as he answered in his ordinary manner. "Well, sir, did you count the branches before?" Then he seemed to relapse, and Painter left him wandering and wavering in the undergrowth and entered the wood like one across whose sunny path a shadow had fallen for an instant. Diving under the wood, he was soon treading a leafy path which even under that summer sun shone only with an emerald twilight, as if it were on the floor of the sea. It wound about more shakily than he had supposed, as if resolved to approach the central trees, as if they were the heart of the maze at Hampton Court. They were the heart of the maze for him anyhow. He sought them as straight as a crooked road would carry him, and turning a final corner, he beheld for the first time the foundations of those towers of vegetation he had as yet only seen from above, as they stood waist-high in the woodland. He found the suspicion correct which supposed the tree branch from one great root, like a candelabrum. The fork, though stained and slimy with green fungolds, was quite near the ground, and offered a first foothold. He put his foot in it, and without a flash of hesitation went aloft, like Jack climbing the beanstalk. Above him, the green roof of leaves and boughs seemed sealed like a firmament of foliage, but by bending and breaking the branches to right and left, he slowly forced a passage upward, and had at last and suddenly the sensation coming out on the top of the world. He felt as if he had never been in the open air before, Sea and land lay in a circle below and about him as he sat astride a branch of the tall tree. He was almost surprised to see the sun still comparatively low in the sky, as if he were looking over a land of eternal sunrise. Silent upon a peak in Darien, he remarked in a needlessly loud and cheerful voice, and though the claim thus expressed was illogical, it was not inappropriate. He did feel as if he were a primitive adventurer just come to the New World, instead of a modern traveler just come from it. I wonder, he proceeded, whether I am really the first that ever burst into this silent tree. It looks like it. He stopped and sat on his branch quite motionless, but his eyes were turned on a branch a little below it, and they were brilliant with a vigilance like those of a man watching a snake. What he was looking at might, at first sight, have been a large white fungus spreading on the smooth and monstrous trunk, but it was not. Leaning down dangerously from his perch, he detached it from the twig on which it had caught, and then sat holding it in his hand and gazing at it. It was Squire Vane's white Panama hat, but there was no Squire Vane under it. Painter felt a nameless relief in the very fact that there was not. There in the clear sunlight and sea air for an instant, all the tropical terrors of his own idle tale surrounded and suffocated him. It seemed indeed some demon tree of the swamps, a vegetable servant that fed on men. Even the hideous farce and the fancy of digesting a whole man with the exception of his hat seemed only to simplify the nightmare, and he found himself gazing dully at one leaf of the tree which happened to be turned toward him, so that the odd markings which had partly made the legend really looked a little like the eye in a peacock's feather. It was as if the sleeping tree had opened one eye upon him. With a sharp effort, he steadied himself in mind and posture on the bough. His reason returned, and he began to descend with the hat in his teeth. When he was back in the underworld of the wood, he studied the hat again with closer attention. In one place in the crown there was a hole or rent, which certainly had not been there when it had last lain on the table under the garden tree. He sat down, lit a cigarette, and reflected for a long time. A wood, even a small wood, is not an easy thing to search minutely, but he provided himself with some practical tests in the matter. In one sense, the very density of the thicket was a help. He could at least see where anyone had strayed from the path, or broken and trampled growths of every kind. After many hours' industry, he had made a sort of new map of the place and had decided beyond doubt that some person or persons had so strayed, for some purpose, in several defined directions. There was a way burst through the bushes, making a shortcut across a loop of the wandering path. There was another forking out from it as an alternative way into the central space, but there was one especially which was unique, and which seemed to him, the more he studied it, to point to some essential of the mystery. One of these beaten and broken tracks went from the space under the peacock trees outward into the woods for about 20 yards and then stopped. Beyond that point, not a twig was broken nor a leaf disturbed. It had no exit, but he could not believe that it had no goal. After some further reflection, he knelt down and began to cut away grass and clay with his knife, and was surprised at the ease with which they detached themselves. In a few moments, a whole section of the soil lifted like a lid. It was a round lid and presented a quaint appearance, like a flat cap with green feathers. For though the disc itself was made of wood, there was a layer of earth on it with the live grass still growing there, and the removal of the round lid revealed a round hole, black as night and seemingly bottomless. Painter understood it instantly. It was rather near the sea for a well to be sunk, but the traveler had known wells sunk even nearer. He rose to his feet with the great knife in his hand, a frown on his face, and his doubts resolved. He no longer shrank from naming what he knew. This was not the first corpse that had been thrown down a well. Here, without stone or epitaph, was the grave of Squire Vane. In a flash, all the mythological follies about saints and peacocks were forgotten. He was knocked on the head, as with a stone club, by the human common sense of crime. Cyprian Painter stood long by the well in the wood, walked around it in meditation, examined its rim and the ring of grass around it, searched the surrounding soil thoroughly, came back and stood beside the well once more. His researches and reflections had been so long that he had not realized the day had passed, and that the wood and the world round it were beginning already to be steeped in the enrichment of evening. The day had been radiantly calm. The sea seemed to be as still as the well, and the well was as still as a mirror. And then, quite without warning, the mirror moved of itself like a living thing. In the well, in the wood, the water leaped and gurgled with a grotesque noise, like something swallowing, and then settled again with a second sound. Cyprian could not see into the well clearly, for the opening from where he stood was an ellipse, a mere slit and a half masked by thistles and rank grass like a green beard. For where he stood now was 3 yards away from the well, and he had not yet himself realized that he had sprung back all that distance from the brink when the water spoke.